another day to live through. Better get started. They want my blood. Their lives are mine. I still get squeamish.
The streets are swarming with truckloads of bodies that they're throwing into that god-awful pit.
Mom, I can't see! I can't see!
Someone else is alive in this world. But where are they? Where are they hiding? Do you want to come with me or do you want to face them? You are one of them.
I was. And without that injection, I'll be one again.
This way! Cover outside!
All of you freaks! Mutations! You're freaks! I'm a man! The last man!
The film I want to talk about tonight is called The Last Man on Earth. It was made in 1964 and stars Vincent Price. And it's a kind of offbeat Richard Matheson book adapted to a movie about vampires.
That was Nick DiMicci speaking about the 1964 sci-fi horror film The Last Man on Earth. Mr. DiMicci is an actor and screenwriter known for such films as Mulberry Street, We Are What We Are, and the Joe Lansdale adaptation Cold in July. In addition, Mr. DiMicci starred in the werewolf thriller Late Phases and helped bring Mr. Lansdale's Happen Leonard book series to television. In 2010, Mr. DiMicci starred in Stakeland, a post-apocalyptic vampire film he co-wrote with frequent collaborator Jim Mickle. And it is, for this fan, one of the best damn movies of the past decade. Seriously, if you haven't seen it yet, check it out. A sequel to Stakeland, originally titled The Stakelander, but now called Stakeland 2, will premiere on Sci-Fi on Saturday, October 15th, with an encore scheduled for the following day. Mr. DiMicci, thanks so much for talking with me today. Now, as with every episode, I have to ask, of any horror film you might have chosen for discussion, why The Last Man on Earth?
It's an offbeat movie. I mean, it's not your standard vampire movie. Kind of like Stakeland in some way. Could be zombies, could be vampires. It's a different take on it. It's a plague that caused the vampires. They're not your typical folklore vampires. And I just have a fascination with apocalyptic stuff. I mean, the idea of being the last man on Earth is pretty interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you did point out that the creatures might very well be vampires, or they could be zombies. And, you know, in this movie, they do shamble about a bit like the zombies that we know now that... And, you know, I remember hearing at one point that George Romero referenced Richard Matheson's I Am Legend as being sort of an inspiration for Night of the Living Dead. And yet, in the novel, the creatures are sort of fast-moving. They have strength. You know, they're kind of formidable in that way. But watching The Last Man on Earth and revisiting it for this conversation and looking at the vampires in this film where they shamble about and they're not terribly intelligent, it seems like Romero was probably drawing inspiration more from this film.
I think so. I think this film and I actually met George Romero once. He's a terrific guy. I think this film and Carnival of Lost Souls are both heavy influences on Night of the Living Dead if you really watch them. You know, they're both black and white. They both predate Night of the Living Dead, and they both have that similar feel to some of the way some of the scenes are shot, especially with the zombie-like creatures and stuff. It's pretty amazing.
The vampires shamble about like zombies, but they can speak. And, you know, the movie has like two kinds of vampires in it. They're the slow, unintelligent types, and then the smarter, more evolved versions. And, you know, that's really, out of all of the film adaptations of the Matheson novel, this is the only one that sort of adopts that idea.
It's the only one that actually sticks to the book in a pretty close way, you know, outside of, you know, obviously, the vampires shambling or running. But outside of that, I mean, it is the closest to the book, and I think the book is a masterpiece. I'd love to see it done really well. Jim and I wanted to do it. Jim Mickle, my partner and that directs everything, my better half. We wanted to do it so bad, and when it came out in 2011, the remake, we were just cringing, and I just knew they were going to CGI those goddamn vampires. So,
yeah, it's it's unfortunate too that it is such a brilliant novel, and yet we've had three very different film adaptations and three very different takes on that story, and yet none of them have really nailed the book, and none of them have done the ending justice. I don't think. Last Man on Earth is probably the closest in terms of the overall story and the tone, and yet it doesn't even quite do the novel's ending justice, which is strange. I mean, we even the titles changed from adaptation to adaptation. We had The Last Man on Earth, and then we have the 70s film The Omega Man with Charlton Heston. When we finally got that remake with Will Smith actually called I Am Legend, I thought to myself, I was like, my God, we're finally going to get the ending. And then we don't get the ending.
probably went the furthest from any of them.
Yeah, it's God. I was stunned at what I saw in that movie. I mean, the vampires weren't that they weren't threatening, even though they were fast moving. But yeah, when you get to that ending, I don't even know why they called it I Am Legend at that point. It's the least like, you know, the source material out of all of the previous adaptations.
It's completely overwritten. Too many writers, probably. Hollywood, bold inky. You have a masterpiece, do the masterpiece.
But. Why do you think that they can't get that ending right, though? You know, it's not like the previous film adaptations didn't have downbeat endings. You know, in fact, all three of them end on sort of a melancholy note. But, you know, none of them seem to understand what the book was really trying to say.
No, they don't. Well, it's a pretty heavy subject. Some people don't want to go there. You know, they don't want to go to the end of us. And that's what fascinated me about the book. It's, you know, Matheson took that on and he did a really good job of it. And in some way, you didn't feel that bad that it was the end of us in Matheson's book. You know, I mean, he fell for the character, obviously, Robert Neville. He's a great character. But it was also just, you know, I think all good horror stories, you know, kind of got to have a heavy, poignant ending. I mean, to make sense, you can't have a happy ending in a horror movie. It doesn't make any sense.
You know, if in the book, Neville is a man who ultimately finds his peace with, you know, not only his own mortality, but the fact that humanity is sort of ended as we've known it or whatever. You know, if you look at The Last Man on Earth, which is a movie that I like quite a bit, but it's the exact opposite. You have Vincent Price railing against what he calls, you know, freaks and mutants. And it's strange that it goes so far astray from Matheson.
Yeah, I mean, the movie has definitely has flaws. I mean, you know, it ain't the greatest, obviously not the greatest horror movie ever made. It's one of my favorites. Probably mostly just because I think it's, you know, Vincent Price, who was completely miscast in this movie. He was a brilliant actor. I mean, and, you know, we only know him from the schlock horror movies that he did and the Hammer films and this and that. You know, people remember him. But if you really look back to Laura and, you know, Towers of London, and you look at some of the movies, you know, he's making movies in the late 30s, and he was a straight-on actor. He gave some great performance. He was a very good actor. And this movie, because it was not that typical schlock horror thing, it was a real character. You know, I think he really gave probably one of his best performances in this film, and that's why I enjoy the film so much. It ain't even the horror stuff that grabs me in it. What grabs me most in it is the scenes where he's desolate and alone, and he's, you know, he's riding in his station wagon through L.A. and it's empty, and he's burning vampires, and then he comes home and he's watching old films of him and his family, and it's just, it's so heartbreaking and poignant, you know, the loneliness of it. And I think he nailed that, I mean, in a wonderful way.
Yeah, and God, when he is watching those home movies, there's that great moment where he starts laughing. He's like cackling, and then he breaks down, and he sells that moment so beautifully, I think.
He does. He's underrated as an actor. I mean, obviously, he's a great, you know, star and a great horror icon, but, you know, he definitely had chops.
Yeah, and, you know, even Richard Matheson, who had written some of Price's movies for Poe, like those AIP, you know, Poe adaptations, you know, obviously he liked him and said so, but even he felt as though Price was miscast. And, you know, at that point, Price was a star mostly known for horror and gothic chillers. And even the marketing of The Last Man on Earth sort of sold it as that. If you look at that original poster, there's this ghostly apparition. There's this big dilapidated gothic mansion sort of, you know, behind his portrait. But, you know, he is so good in the lead role, and I wonder if, you know, Matheson wasn't so much displeased with the work as he was maybe like the baggage that Price brought with him in the role.
Probably more the baggage. I think you're right. I think, I mean, he was not Robert Neville. I mean, he was probably 15, 20 years too old at the time, you know, to play the character in the book. But, you know, and of course they change a lot. They changed who he was. You know, he's just basically a factory plant worker in the book. He's just a regular guy. Here he's a scientist who was working on the plague, which is fine. I mean, I get it. Screenwriter bullshit. But I think you're right. I think that Matheson probably just didn't think the movie got what he did. And I think it has a lot to do with the ending, like you said, you know, there was something in the book that was just so beautiful about his acceptance of the situation. You know, it's over. That's a beautiful thing. You know, it's just and to get that kind of a thing in a horror thing is just a wonderful, you know, it's a wonderful thing to read or, you know, most horror is just, you know, there for the horror. And when you can tie horror in socially and, you know, make a statement with horror as a political commentary or however, I always think it's much, much better. And, you know, and that statement about the end, I mean, you know, you look at the world right now and you go, whoa, how far are we? You know?
You know, it is interesting, like, looking at the ending of the movie where, you know, Price is sort of wounded in the side and, you know, he's speared while he's on an altar. And then, you know, mm-hmm. that's sort of a fate that's not too terribly different from how Charlton Heston winds up in The Omega Man. And then yeah. you have I Am Legend, the Will Smith character, sort of nobly sacrificing himself. And even in Last Man on Earth, Morgan is showing as being kind of a religious man. And, you know, am I completely wrong, do you think, in thinking that there is a bit of religious symbolism in those movies and those adaptations? It's not really there in the novel?
No, it's not in the novel. It is in the movies, definitely. I mean, they went for it. And I mean, I can't fault them for it. I use religious, and I'm a total atheist, but I use religious stuff all the time in my writing and stuff. It's a quick and powerful way to get a message across. You know, even if we don't believe, we're exposed to it since we're born. So we respond emotionally to certain images and things. And I think, you know, I think that's where people, you know, it's a shortcut.
I gotta ask, as a writer, I mean, can I ask your opinion on the film's screenplay? You know, you look at it and structurally it's, you know, it's kind of a bit messy at times. You know, there's no, you know, inciting incident at minute 15, say, or, you know, there's that really long flashback that begins the second act, such as it is. And, you know, Ruth, who is essentially the film's second lead, she doesn't arrive until like an hour into this 90-minute long film. And yet it all works. It doesn't really follow any of the rules as we know them. And yet it's still powerful with all.
It's another one of the reasons I probably gravitate to this movie, because it's, you know, I really like stuff that's out of the bounds, that is not what you normally expect. You know, I think Stakeland was similar to that in structure, and, you know, it rambled on. We didn't know where we were going. You know, there was no set plan in a way, and things just kind of fell in where they fell in. And, you know, there was no first, second, third act break or any of that bullshit, which works. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with it, but, when you do see something that's outside that box, it's kind of interesting. And, you know, and I got to, again, give credit to Vincent Price. You know, he carried the movie on his shoulders. And the most riveting moments to me were not the flashbacks or the interactions with him and other people. It was him when he was alone is just fascinating. I could have watched a whole movie just him surviving alone would have been fine with me.
It is weird that the movie seems at times like it's sort of over-reliant on exposition. You know, the movie opens with sort of a long bit of narration, and then we do have a 15-minute long flashback to set everything up. And yet at the same time, there are long stretches that seem solely sort of interested in mood. And
Matheson actually worked on the screenplay. Obviously, he probably wrote the original screenplay. I'm not sure, but I know he worked on the screenplay and wrote it and changed his name on the finished product because he didn't like what they did with it, which is kind of interesting, you know. Which I'm sure they added in all that other stuff, you know, the flashbacks to explain how the plague started and all that stuff, you know, which is typical, you know, everybody wants that kind of stuff, you know, and I just don't understand why. If it's a plague, it's a plague. I mean, you know, why do we have to explain how it happened? If it happened tomorrow, you think half the survivors would know what happened? No. You know what I mean? They wouldn't know, you know, so, but it's, you know. Again, it's, you know, it's suits and money and producers, and, you know, they get involved and they want it their way, and they, you know, they're putting the money up. So sometimes, you know, it's why we're calling Stakelander Stakeland 2, which is, it's just, the director just sent me an email apologizing basically to me, feeling really bad. And I was like, hey, what are you going to do?
I will say, as a fan of the original movie, and I do love that original film, when I heard the title as being the Stakelander for, you know, the second film, I was like, ah, that sounds... It sounds mythic in a way. And, you know, plus it also kind of raises a question as to who the title might be referring to. Is the Stakelander Mr. or is the Stakelander Martin? And so I really appreciated that title. And, you know, I don't think, as a fan, there's nothing wrong with Stakeland 2. I don't think, you know, I love Stakeland, and there's a 2 after it. It's telling me I'm getting more of what I love. So I'm okay with that. And yet I got to say, as a fan too, when I heard that it wasn't going to be that original title anymore, I was a little depressed. I was a little disappointed.
somebody thinks they're going to make more money by calling it Steak Planta 2, so they're calling it Steak Planta 2. At least in America, anyway, and there's these releases. I know in Europe it'll probably be the Steaklander, so it's fine.
Can I ask for a second, you know, considering that there is sort of a similarity between, you know, in genre anyway, or subgenre, between Last Man on Earth and Steakland, would you call it kind of, how much of an inspiration would you say the movie is, if at all, to your work?
In Steakland, yes, definitely. It was an inspiration. I mean, the biggest movie, ironically, funny, you know, in Steakland, the biggest, and I've said this before, but the biggest inspiration in Steakland was John Wayne's The Searchers. You know, that is the basic story, you know. I even named the kid Martin in it, which is, you know, and which is the same movie in a sense. It's, you know, a guy taking a kid on a journey. But horror-wise, yeah, Night of the Living Dead was huge. And also Last Man on Earth, you know, was one me and Jim had been talking about for a long time, kicking it around. And somehow I think a lot of that found its way into Steakland. The idea of it being a plague I thought was really interesting, you know. And also to free us up as far as vampires go and not have to pay attention to vampire lore, you know what I mean? You know, garlic and crosses and all that stuff, you know, taking it out of that romantic vampire realm, the Anne Rice realm, which I love. Don't get me wrong. I've read all the books and I think they're terrific. A little homoerotic for me, but that's okay. So I think definitely it was an influence. I don't know how much of that was conscious and how much was subconscious, but looking at the film now and thinking about it, yes, definitely.
You mentioned the vampire lore, and, you know, looking at The Last Man on Earth, it is really interesting that, you know, it sort of addresses all of the sort of superstitions surrounding vampires, and then it sort of explains them away with a scientific angle, you know. With mirrors, it's that vampires can't stand to see their reflection. With stakes, you know, they work because they won't allow a vampire's wound to close up. You know, infected systems are allergic to garlic, that sort of thing. And it's a really interesting angle to take, and I can't think of another vampire film or film of that sort of took that angle before The Last Man on Earth. Up until that point, it was all Universal and Hammer and Gothic chillers and, you know, the lore surrounding all of that. And it's neat that Last Man on Earth was sort of forward-thinking and that it applied a scientific angle to all of that.
Yeah, and he broke a mold. I mean, you know, he created the vampire that we hadn't seen, you know, which I think is kind of cool. You know, if you look at folklore, I mean, there's so many various types of vampires. I mean, it's just insane. I mean, they were Romans, the Chinese, everybody had vampires, and they were all called something different, and they're all slightly different. The Chinese vampires are amazing. I forget the exact name they call them, but it translates to hopper, because they don't walk, they kind of hop, and they're stiff like they have rigor mortis. And I just would love to see one of those in a movie someday.
That would be really cool. We haven't seen anything like that I can think of. Like, as a matter of fact, you know, most of the time when vampires hit the screen, it's you know, it seems like we have the different classes, but for the most part, they all sort of descend from the same sort of European approach to vampires, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. You know, Byron and Stoker and those guys who, you know, who established them literally in literature, basically set the mold for what a vampire is. And, you know, in folklore, I mean, there are, you know, it's almost like the video games. You got brutes, you got, you know, different classes of vampire. And, in the folklore, when you read it, you have that. You have vampires who are like, you know, live in caves and, you know, they're almost like wild animals. And we call them berserkers in Steakland. And that we did try and do that in Steakland, is to give us different types of vampires. And the fact that it was a disease, it was also evolving and changing. So I think that's the kind of interesting thing, is that we can always reinvent these things and make them somewhat new again.
Very cool. And, you know, it is kind of funny looking at The Last Man on Earth, where, you know, it is dealing with the vampire tropes, and yet, you know, we're told that the plague has essentially originated in Europe. I thought it was kind of a funny nod to their origins.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Well, vampires. But, there's an actual disease, Plephoria, I think it's called. It's Slavic. Most people who have it have Slavic descent, and it's a weird iron liver disease. You basically don't process iron, so you get too much iron in your system. The cure for it is to bleed you. You have to go get bled once in a while to get the iron out of your system. And the symptoms, I mean, the side effects of too much iron in your body is you can't take sunlight, you blister in the sun. You know, it's all vampire stuff. So it's kind of a pretty interesting, you know, that it may have some roots in a disease in that area, you know, Romania and then the Slavic Baltic countries. So, you know, most things do go back to some kind of reality, you know, no matter what they are. So.
Yeah. Can we talk for a second about the sort of craft that went into The Last Man on Earth? I mean, with, you know, it had sort of a low budget, you know, it had scratchy black and white photography, and, you know, AIP released it. And, you know, one might be forgiven for thinking that Last Man at first glance is sort of a cheap exploitative sort of B movie, but, you know, it has much more weight than that, I think. And it takes itself much more seriously, you know, except for those terrible bombs that Morgan drops in the finale. You know, it's a pretty straightforward, you know, pretty grim thriller throughout, but it's so beautifully made in a way.
Yeah, I think some of it is just gorgeous. I mean, like I said, those scenes in empty, just shooting, how did they empty out Los Angeles? I mean, he's driving on highways and through. It's just insane, and it looks wonderful. And it's probably shot in Italy. Maybe it wasn't shot in L.A. I don't know.
It was shot in Rome.
Oh, and it was in Rome. Okay. It was Baldo Ragona, maybe?
Yes, yeah.
Sidney Sallow, I think, were the directors. I have no idea who they are, to be honest with you. But I think it was originally going to be a bigger movie, and then for whatever reason, somebody decided that they weren't going to put that kind of money into it, and ended up being a much lower budget. And maybe it suffered for it, but maybe it didn't. I don't know. I mean, it is what it is, and I think it stands up. I mean, you know, it's one of those movies. There's a couple of them, you know, that I'm, you know, if I'm clicking around the TV at some time, I only watch old movies on TV, basically. And, you know, if I come across the original King Kong, I don't care what part of the movie's on, I stop and I watch the rest of the movie. I can't help it. I'm hooked. This is one of those movies. If it's on, I have to watch it. And it's just, you know, like I said, I'm not going to say it's the greatest movie ever made, but I think for a movie to have that kind of power, you know, is pretty interesting. And I would love to. I never have. I would love to see it on a big screen.
Oh yeah, that would be incredible, I would think, because there are shots in the movie. I mean, some of it looks like it was done kind of on the fly and on the cheap, and they were just probably running around stealing shots where they could. But, you know, some of the compositions in the movie are really breathtaking. There's that amazing sequence when Price is taking his wife out to be buried, and he steps out of the car. It's just incredible. But I did a bit of reading, you know, as research for this conversation. I looked it up, and yeah, it was shot in Rome, Italy, and the director is credited as being Sidney Salko on the print of the film, and yet by all accounts, including the commentary that was on that Scream Factory disc of the movie that came out not that long ago in one of those Vincent Price collections, apparently the actual director was Ubaldo Ragona, who directed the film, and apparently Salko had just sort of taken the film and tidied it up and made some cuts for AIP, and as a result, his name is the one that graces the film, which is kind of, well, it's more than a little unfortunate, but apparently neither director had made that many movies between them.
Huh.
But yeah, that's such a shame that it is a damn good film, and yet the guy who actually, I mean, by all accounts made it, you know, he's not credited as such. Being shot in Italy, you know, it's set in Los Angeles, but it gives the movie a sort of otherworldly feel, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, you know, what do I know? Los Angeles in 1964? You know, it's all new now, so I wouldn't even know what it was like. You know, it's kind of like a Touch of Evil. You know, it's all shot right in Venice. I mean, and you know, I've been to that area, and you actually look around, a lot of those buildings are still there, and they used it as Mexico. It's pretty amazing. So when you see that kind of creativity, and you know, it just shows you what you can do in film. And you know, nowadays they kind of generally take the easy way out and shoot everything where it's supposed to be. And you know, I kind of like when they created stuff. It's like the CGI to me. I mean, I love it as a you know, as a tool. You know, you can enhance things with CGI, but when it's just CGI, I have no interest there. You know, the creatures have no soul; they're just computer animated creatures. They don't interest me. You know, Jackson does it best, obviously, and you know. Maybe that's the future, but I still rather see something behind the creature. You know, you look at King Kong and it was a puppet, basically. You know, it was a couple different pieces. You know, they had a giant head, a giant hand, and then they had the basic puppet. But And even a puppet, there's somebody there grooming it and molding it and putting it in position. And it became a character that was alive, you know, and I think that's because there was a humanity to it. And I just don't think you can get that through a computer. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just old and old fashioned, but that's me.
No, I agree with you entirely. And I think the perfect example of that is looking at the villains in The Last Man on Earth and looking at the Omega Man. And, you know, it was a little bit of makeup and they shambled about and maybe they weren't always threatening, especially in Last Man when Vincent Price can pretty much deflect them with a slap upside the head. But you know what? They're still more threatening than something I don't believe is being there physically with the actor, as with I Am Legend, you know.
Yeah.
I think we were meant to be awed by all of those creatures, and instead I remember watching the movie, and you know, Smith gave a good performance, and it's not a terribly made film, but I never bought any of the more thrilling sequences because of that.
No, and they all look the same.
Yeah.
All those creatures in that movie looked the same to me. It was just, you know, now we're going to make a million of them. You know, it's kind of like the new Planet of the Apes movies. I don't find them interesting because the apes are not individuals. They're just computer-generated copies of each other, basically. You know, except for one lead ape or something they'll put some effort into. And it doesn't sell it for me. You know, I'd much rather see Roddy McDowell in ape makeup. Yeah. He's somebody under there.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Why do you, can I ask, just, you know, as a fan of these movies and as somebody who works in the industry, why do you think that is? I mean, I would imagine it's not cheap to make all of those creatures in I Am Legend as opposed to just painting up extras and having them race at the character. And it would work so much better. And do you think we're going to be stuck with CG creatures from here on out? Or do you think there will eventually be a turn where we go back to more practical effects and animatronic creatures or makeup effects?
You know, it's a toss-up. I honestly don't know. No, you know, everybody calls me a filmmaker, and I'm not a filmmaker. I'm a writer and an actor, and I always stand by that. I get handed producer credits because they have to give them to me, but I'm not even really a producer. You know, I've been on sets, you know, in late phases, they did practical effects. And, you know, it was a killer, man. It took forever to shoot the transformation. I mean, it was just murder on a low budget movie. So I understand why people sometimes, but when you've got a big budget movie, I don't understand why you would, you know, go the other way when you don't have to. I mean, I just don't find it as effective, but I'm sure it comes down to money in some way. Most things do, unfortunately.
And it's such a shame, especially considering that, you know, you look at all the strides we made from even like The Last Man on Earth to movies of the 80s when there were a lot of practical effects in the 90s before there was an option to do computer-generated effects, you know? And I can only imagine where we would be now with that craft if we didn't have that computer crutch, as it were, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some, you know, I watched recently the new Star Wars, which I had bought to go see. It was on TV or something. I watched it, part of it. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I watched it. And, I mean, I think they do a good job in that of combining both, you know, of using live and you know, live actors and costumes, and then using the CGI as a crutch, which I think is, you know, then it kind of works. In Stakeland, Jim used it a bit. The scene with the little girl when Martin goes up in the attic and the girl is laying there, her smile when she smiles, he tweaked it. You know, he just stretched it a little too far. You know, and he did that with computers. And you know, I think sometimes it can be really effective. But when it's all you're seeing, I mean, I might as well be watching a video game. That doesn't interest me.
Not me either.
But I don't like watching.
Yeah. You know, looking at what this movie might have been, too, you mentioned that, you know, there's a possibility that it might have had a larger budget at one point. You know, I did a little research on it and found that at one point Fritz Lang was actually going to be the director of the film. You know, the guy who gave us Metropolis and M. And I can only imagine. That would have been probably pretty incredible. I mean, I like the film, and I'm not knocking the film for his absence, but you imagine somebody like that directing that tale, you know?
Yeah, with a budget.
Yeah, it could have been incredible. And apparently, I guess the reason the project even existed in the first place was because the novel rights, you know, were purchased for Hammer Films to produce.
Yeah.
And in a way, like, I can kind of see that. I can see what Hammer's interest would be in it. I love Hammer horror, but at the same time, you know, The Last Man on Earth feels, not just in setting, but in attitude, it feels much more modern than the stuff that Hammer was sort of doing at that time.
Now, maybe that has to do with the fact that it was made in Italy, you know, in Europe. It plays much more like a European film, where it does break those boundaries of, like you said, there's no set acts, there's no, you know, in Europe they're much more comfortable with that kind of avant-garde kind of, you know, bohemian art, whereas, you know, America has always kind of leaned towards the corporate model of how you do things. So I don't know, it's a, you know, it's a toss-up. Would it, you know, would it have served it to have been made here and bigger? I don't know. You know, they weren't making those kind of movies here when you think about it. I mean, really, you know, the, you know, we're remembering, like I said, Carnival of Lost Souls, Night of the Living Dead, those kind of, but they came later. They were even, this predates those. I can't think of a movie before 1964 that even comes near this movie for that kind of apocalyptic, you know, really sci-fi horror thing. I don't think anybody was making them, you know. So they were doing Edgar Rice Burroughs movies, you know, which were great in their own way, but I mean, they certainly weren't this. This was much more poignant and thought-provoking.
And at times it feels like, you know, it feels like there is a war waging within the movie at times where you can feel it almost wants to be kind of a B-movie at times, but it also kind of wants to be an art house film.
Yeah, no, I think it is an art house film. I really, you know, if some student had made this film today, I'd be fascinated by it. You know, you know, who knows? Would there have been a Night of the Living Dead if not for a movie like this? I don't know. You know, I don't know. I don't think it gets the credit that's due it. I think it's treated more like it was just a schlocky little horror movie, and I think it's much more than that.
I agree. And I, you know, I love George Romero. I think he's brilliant. I love all of the Dead films, and, you know, certainly with, you know, say The Walking Dead being such a huge part of pop culture right now, you know, we, I think some people credit that to, you know, the comic that it's based on, certainly. But I think going further back, people credit Romero for creating the thing that is now, you know, insanely popular. And yet, yeah, I think The Last Man on Earth is due its fair share of credit for that now.
Oh, yeah. No, you know, like I said, I met George Romero once in Trieste at a film festival, and I talked to him a lot, and he, you know, he doesn't feel like he broke any ground with that movie. You know, it all came from someplace, and, you know, he's very open about that. It's not like, you know, I mean, he loves the results of what it was, but he's not taking credit for creating, you know, anything. He just did what he does, and that's kind of wonderful about him. You know, he's a very humble guy. And he did. He made it popular. Let's put it that way. Nobody else had made that kind of thing popular, and he did. That movie was, I saw that movie when I was probably 8 or 9 years old in Peekskill, New York, at a drive-in up in the country. I was scared shitless. Me and my brother went to my grandparents had a house up there, like a little in the country. I mean, it was just a house from the movie, basically. But we had a plan. We were going to pull down the crawl space attic door. It was one of those ladder doors. You reached up and pulled the thing, and it came down like an accordion door. We were going to pull that down and get hammers and climb up and pull it up and then sit by the attic windows. And if they climbed up on the roof, we'd hit them on the head with a hammer.
Hey, that's a good plan. I don't think you can be a fan of the genre and not consider what your own personal post-apocalyptic zombie plan would be.
That was my 9-year-old plan, but I wasn't thinking about food.
So I, as a fan, can I ask, which do you prefer? Which do you find creepier? Because you are right. I mean, Romero certainly popularized that type of zombie and added to them in such a way that was completely indelible. I mean, he, at no point, as much as I like The Last Man on Earth, do I find the vampires or zombies very frightening. But I can still watch Night of the Living Dead and be incredibly creeped out by those shambling flesh eaters.
But yeah. He broke ground. I mean, he definitely broke ground. I mean, the you know, eating legs and intestines and, you know, some of the most frightening things I've ever seen. And in some way, he made it like it seemed so real. It was like watching a documentary, you know, Romero's film. And, you know, it really was impressive and sticks with you. Like I say, I mean, it still sticks with me, that movie, you know. You know, the fact that he cast a black guy as the lead actor, you know, nobody was thinking of doing that, you know. And I don't know if he did it thinking about it or if he just did it. And everything kind of was right, you know, and I think that's more the case. He just was making a low-budget movie, and, you know, But he broke ground, and you know, he made political statements that were just, I don't even know if he was attempting to. You know, the scenes with the guys with the guns and the dogs, and you know, they're right out of the civil rights movement. I mean, and it's just, you know, and yet I don't know if that was planned. I really don't think it was. I think it was just in the air. You know what I mean? Those were the years, the late 60s, when you're having the riots and all that stuff was going on. So, you know, I think it was just in the air, and he just transformed it into film in some way, and made it a very, very powerful movie. On the other hand, I got to say, in Last Man on Earth, the thing that impressed me a lot about it is Morgan. His name is Morgan. The character who was the other doctor, the young, good-looking Italian guy.
Ben Cortman.
Yes, Ben Cortman. That character was great because you rarely see these movies where the creature is actually someone you knew. And when he's outside banging on the door going, Morgan, that was just freaky as shit. You know, because it was somebody you actually said, holy shit, man. You know, it's like when his wife came back after he buried her. There's something really creepy about that. That made it really cool.
It adds that sort of melancholy feel to the movie that wouldn't be there otherwise, especially after we get the flashback and we get to know Cortman as a guy. He was a nice guy. He was his friend, you know, but he's also the biggest threat to him in the present day, which is, you know, it just twists that knife that much more, I think.
Yeah, totally.
So I got to ask, as a fan of these movies, which do you find more threatening typically? Because they're always me personally, I love them both, so I don't really understand the argument. And inevitably, though, when people start talking like zombies, there's always the slow zombies versus fast zombies debate. Where do you sort of fall on that?
You know, I'm kind of in between. It really depends. I love Danny Boyle's the first one, you know, which was the first zombie movie to take on that kind of fast zombie thing. Yet there's something really creepy about something that ain't moving fast, and it's just kind of, you know, just kind of waddling at you is kind of frightening. So I don't know. I mean, you know, cinematically, I actually prefer the slower moving zombies because the fast ones, it just becomes an action movie, you know. And the other ones, I mean, there's time at least, you know. So in the real world, obviously, I much prefer to have slow moving zombies. Probably outrun them. But in film, I actually find the slower ones a little bit more creepy.
Yeah, same here.
You know, you think about the Mummy, the original Mummy movies. You know, the Mummy was always dragging one leg, and he was crippled in one arm. And he could barely, you know, he could, like, drag himself across the floor, but he caught everybody. You know, he couldn't run. I was like, how does he catch everybody? But he
did. Yeah, it's very true. You know, I think when it comes to slower zombies, on their own, they're not terribly, you know, intimidating. And yet with all of those movies, the thing that makes them intimidating is the fact that they always come with masses, you know. And, you know, even mentioning, you know, like Night of the Living Dead, the end with that mob, it is curious that, you know, you look at The Last Man on Earth and you look at Night of the Living Dead, they both end with mobs of people, and not necessarily the slower shambling people, but the more intelligent versions of, I mean, we have, you know, rednecks with shotguns and Night of the Living Dead, but, you know, with Last Man on Earth, it is the essentially the next step in, well, what would you call it? Humanity, as it were?
Next step in human evolution.
Yeah, and I always wanted to see a follow-up to Matheson's tale. I mean, it has the perfect ending, and yet, you know, being a reader and being a fan of that book, I always kind of wanted to see what came next with that that sort of civilization. And that's something we've never gotten from that tale, you know, whether it be you know, any of Romero's Dead movies, or, you know, even The Walking Dead that we have now, or we have any of the adaptations of Matheson's novel. We never really see what comes next. And I've always wanted to see that. It's the one thing I was kind of interested in seeing with, you know, even though I didn't really so much care for the Will Smith I Am Legend adaptation, they were threatening a sequel at one point, and I thought, well, I would still watch it. I would still want to see where they're going to take that idea if it weren't completely CG.
You know, I just don't know. I mean, a world where everybody's, you know, infected and taking drugs I just don't know how interesting that is. I mean, Matheson, I'm trying to think, and I'm a pretty big reader. I can't think of a thing that Matheson ever did that he did a sequel to. I don't think he ever wrote a sequel to anything. And he wrote some brilliant, brilliant, really good books and great screenplays and tons of Twilight Zones and all that. Everything he's ever done has been wonderful. I don't think he ever did a sequel, so there's something kind of interesting just in that. But, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything you needed to say was said pretty much within that initial story, mm-hmm. I suppose. But yeah, I love Matheson. I'm a huge Twilight Zone fan, and all of his episodes were gems.
Gems. I mean, you know, yeah, that's a sad thing to me that anthology is just gone. You know, it was just a wonderful, wonderful thing for actors, for directors, for writers, you know, different people getting jobs and work and, you know, all those, the One Step Beyonds, the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, you know, and nobody's doing it now. It's just like, I don't understand it. You know, it's just like, God, it's such a wonderful thing to know you're going to watch something that's similar in some way. You know what you're going to get, but it's not a series. It's not a continuation. And that's what I think has a lot to do with, you know, corporate. They don't want to deal with all new people. They want to lock down a cast, lock down people, and just, you know, and it just becomes corporate. So.
Yeah, I agree. I love anthologies, not only on television, but films, too. And it seems like, you know, maybe at a certain level where there's a little bit of a resurgence with, you know, feature anthologies that's kind of happening now. You know, I'm thinking of like the VHS trilogy or, you know, Southbound or Holidays that just came out. Yeah, or even
television things. I mean, the way they're doing the American Horror Story, it's pretty interesting that they, you know, keep most of the cast and do a whole different story every season. Not that, you know, each one is great. I mean, I love the one with the circus. That was brilliant. But that's kind of an interesting, you know, different way of going at something that I thought was pretty good. So.
Yeah, and yeah, it's I just, you know, we were mentioning the Twilight Zone. I can't believe that no one is out there taking advantage of that property and telling great stories under that sort of flag. I mean, we had, you know, for as huge a part as of pop culture as it is, you know, that original series only ran for 5 years, and there was a brief, you know, they brought it back briefly in the 80s and then once in the early aughts, but they never, you know, those two remakes
never worked again.
No.
Even the Limits, the same thing, you know, the originals are so much better than when they tried to reinvent it.
Yeah. And it's, but you know, I guess part of it too, is it has to be, you know, how do you find another Rod Serling? How do you find another voice to shepherd that? I mean, he was unique, I think. But yeah, so brilliant. And, you know, at least he had an eye for bringing in, like, you know, writers like Richard Matheson and Charles Beaumont and, you know, guys like that. So he saw brilliance in others and was able to bring them in. And I wonder if part of it, you know, looking at those, the Twilight Zone of the 80s and the one, you know, from about 10, 15 years ago, it seemed like they were only interested in telling a creepy story with a twist. It seemed like the twist was the important thing. And, you know, if you look at the original series, yeah, there were twists, but it was always about the human condition. It was always about humanity. And
they were character driven.
Yeah.
I think most things nowadays suffer from that, you know. I mean, it's just, you know, you see it in music and in everything nowadays. You know, people are so narcissistic and they want to see themselves. They don't want to see anything different. They don't want to see period pieces. They don't want to see old people. You know, it's just like, you know, and I think we suffer for it. We've also lost the short story. I mean, you know, like I say, I'm an avid reader, and you know, and I there's some great writing out there. Don't get me wrong. There's still some great writing out there, but nobody's writing short stories. And you know, short stories. I mean, Edgar Allan Poe was a short story writer. He wrote one novel. You know, everything else he wrote was short stories. You know, and Mark Twain, another guy, you know, wrote a couple of novels, but most of his stuff was short stories. And I think that's it's an art we've lost. You know, people. You know, it's, how can I sell it?
Yeah. Which, God, that is terrible to think that's why those art forms are sort of, they're not dead, but they're certainly on the decline. And that's a horrible reason for it. But, you know, I think Matheson too, you know, if you look at some of his Twilight Zones, he was preoccupied, I think, with telling character driven stories and, you know, ordinary people in extraordinary situations. And that certainly carried over to his novel work. And, you know, The Last Man on Earth, even for being, you know, it's a pretty close adaptation, but it takes liberties. But it seemed to keep that, you know, it was character driven as a film and it was concerned with, you know, the human condition, I think, you know, at least so far as Morgan was concerned.
Yeah, no. And that's why I even hold it above Night of the Living Dead in a way as far as that. You know, I think it really was a character-driven piece, and you know, that's what fascinated me. I mean, you know, you could compare it to Robinson Crusoe in a way. You could, you know, there's something classic about that story, and you know, it's a man surviving, and that's always a, you know, that's a great story, you know. You could tell it a million times, and it's always interesting. You know, a man surviving alone is just one of those great classic things. And I don't think that'll ever go out in a way, you know, that kind of a story. You know, there's only so many stories you can tell. Man against man against nature, you know, man against himself. You know, so, and I don't mean man as man, you know, we can include women in there. I'm just using the term man for humans. But I think once you get away from the character, I'm not interested. I don't care how good the twists and the turns and the action and all that stuff is. For me, it always comes down to the character.
Yeah, and it's certainly what interests me most as, you know, as a fan, a viewer, a reader. So, and that's why I really dig this film. I think it certainly has that in spades. And, you know, going back to the ending for a second and the fact that it did differ so much from Matheson's novel, rather than there being that sort of acceptance, he sort of, you know, Morgan kind of rages against his murderers at the end. How do you feel about that? Do you think that it was an interesting sort of take on the material or an interesting change, or do you kind of regret that they made that choice?
It's hard to say. I mean, I actually, you know, I probably saw the movie before I ever read the book, to be honest with you. And I probably saw it 64. I'm 56. So I probably saw it when I was a kid. Can't remember when I read the book, which I've read at least 3 or 4 times now. Still love that book. It's a tough one. I mean, it's complete. You know, it is, I believe, Vincent Price. That's the thing. You know what I mean? I think he did sell that ending. With his character, you know, he pulled a Dylan Thomas, you know, did not go gently into that good night, rage against the coming of the light. You know, it was a choice. And, you know, yet in the novel, I just love that he didn't rage, that he just accepted and, you know, went quietly. And there's something kind of very interesting about that, too. So I guess I'd have to see it to really decide which one I like better in a film. So hopefully one day we'll see a good adaptation.
That would be fantastic. I, you know, they did keep, at least, I felt like they tried to hew close to the novel's ending a little bit in those final moments when, you know, you have Morgan telling Ruth, you know, they were afraid of me, they were afraid of me, they were afraid of me. And she says they didn't know, but we hear a child crying in the background, and we realize that, you know, the child isn't crying because Morgan died. It's probably afraid because it was so close to essentially what it considered was the boogeyman. You know, all along, from their point of view, he was the menace. From a certain point of view, he was the boogeyman. And, you know, we end with the child crying and Ruth telling him, don't cry, we're all safe now. And it feels like that hewed closely to the notion of him being a legend, although in a very different way, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it is a novel, and, you know, the thing about novels, you know, and that are turned into, obviously, adapted into screenplays is that they are interpretations. So I always give them a little more, you know, I'm not one of those people who think you have to, if you're adapting a book, you're adapting it, you're not doing the book. I don't think you need to take too much license with something, but I think it gives you some artistic license. And, you know, that's the choice. I mean, and they obviously made this choice, and, you know, I wouldn't. I would like to see the ending that you like and I like. I'd like to at least see a version with that ending and, you know, let history tell us if we were right or wrong.
That would be pretty amazing. I could see something like, you know, especially considering how popular horror is on television right now, that is in, you know, the sort of the television show format. Even, you know, the classics aren't getting remade so much anymore as they are being ported over to television. You know, you think about, like, Hannibal Lecter became a television series. The Exorcist is now on TV, you know. And with The Walking Dead being so popular, I don't think it would be completely outside the realm of possibility for I Am Legend to eventually make its way to television.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody's trying to sell it right now.
But the only unfortunate thing, I think that could be kind of interesting and kind of amazing, especially considering how well some of these television shows have done and how well they've been made. But, you know, if it becomes a long form story, then, you know, that ending goes away, I think, again.
Yeah. And, you know, my problem with series, you know, hey, I'm working on Happy Leonard, which I love and it's terrific and everybody's great in it. And, you know, it's what an opportunity. I'm not, you know, my fear with serial stuff is, you know, how long can you go on before it becomes a soap opera? You know, you look at Sopranos, which when it came out kind of broke the box. You're like, what's this? This is so different. You know, but by the end, it was just a soap opera. And I think that's the fate of long form television. You know, in Europe, they do series, but they only plan on doing a season or two. You know, in America, it's like, if it's making money, just keep it going. It's, you know, Walking Dead. I mean, you know, it's like, hey, I'm done. You know, I'm sorry, I'm done. It's like, you know, you're killing zombies. We're just, you know, everything gets oversaturated. And it's a fear to me, you know. It's like, eventually, you know, nobody's going to want to ever see another vampire or another zombie, you know. It's like, these things come and go, and you got to let them come and go. And just trying to keep them around, you know, for a buck is, you know, there's a million stories out there to tell. Tell something different.
It would be interesting to see it go that route, but I agree with you, too, that I wouldn't want to see it trotted out season after season. And what is Robert Neville going to do this season? Well, he's going to kill more vampires. You know, it seems like they could sort of run that story into the ground. I agree.
I wouldn't mind seeing a mini series version of it, you know, where you tell the whole story in 6 episodes or whatever it is, and that's it. You know, which is how they used to, you know, years ago they did that. They adapted stuff for television like that, and they do like 4 2-hour movies, Centennial, you know, a bunch of them, you know. It was very popular in the 70s as a format, and I'd rather see that kind of a format, you know, than long-term, you know, trying to get 5 to 7 seasons out of something and just, you know.
I agree. If you had the opportunity, would you, what would be the ideal way for you to tell the story of I Am Legend?
I do it. I'm a film guy, basically. I think if you can't tell your story in an hour and a half, then why are you telling it? Yeah. What is television? It's all set up for advertising. Let's be honest. You know, I'm not saying it's bad. You know, the product can be great, but the bottom line is you're selling product. And there's a lot of money in it. And that's why people do it. And it's how people watch things nowadays. Who goes to the movies anymore? You know? So it's a changing world, and you got to change with it. But ultimately, you know, a film is a film. It's not there to sell anything. It's there to tell a story, just that. And you're not worried about commercial breaks or, you know, turning the audience off or, you know, insulting somebody or being politically correct. You're creating art. And, you know, I think that's what we're losing in this world, you know, where we're afraid to say what we think. And, you know, we might hurt somebody's feelings. And it's kind of sad to me. I mean, you know, because I'd rather have my feelings hurt by somebody telling me the truth than having somebody stifle what they think because they don't want to hurt my feelings. Because then I don't know what they really think. That's where politically correct is.
I agree. I get kind of terrified occasionally when I take to Twitter and see what the newest thing to rage about is, and feel as though that is. I wonder if the art form is affected by sort of that political correctness and that sort of like tendency for outrage on Twitter and all forms of social media. And if so, do you think it more affects television than film, or do you think it affects them both, or maybe not at all?
I think it affects them both a bit, but I think it definitely affects television much more because television is run by people who are advertising, and they're the ones who make the calls that say you can't do this, you can't do that. You know, they don't want anyone to be insulted by, you know, they want people to watch their commercials, and people are going to turn off your program because they don't like what you're saying, and they're not going to get to watch the commercials to buy the products that these people are trying to sell. That's the cold, hard reality of what it is, and leads through from film to everything, you know, to politics. I mean, why is, you know, it's, you want a horror movie, look at our fucking presidential election, Jesus Christ. You know, but there it is. I mean, why is Trump even getting any attention? Well, because he's the first fucking asshole to say what the fuck he thinks, or maybe he doesn't think it, but he's just saying the most outrageous shit, and people respond to it, you know, so, I don't know, you know, but at least he's saying it, you know what I mean? At least he's fucking saying it. So it's, you know, I look at Hillary and I go, what the fuck? I don't know what she thinks anymore. I can't figure her out. I don't trust her. I don't trust anybody, but I don't eat, you know. It's kind of like, you know, do you really want a Hitler who's going to be politically correct so you don't know what he's going to do? That scares me worse than anything. You know, so I don't know. The world's gone nuts.
It just occurred to me, if I Am Legend went to television, you know, after this conversation, it probably would have a happy ending too. So maybe it'd be best if it didn't go that route. Well, sir, I think that is just about our time. Thank you so much for coming on and for choosing such a great film to talk about. I really appreciate it. Can I ask, where can fans find you online, and what should we keep an eye out from you in the future?
If they can figure it out, they can get on my – I have a Twitter thing. They can tweet all they want. And there's a Facebook page for Nick D'Amici somewhere. I look at it once in a while. I can't say I look at it all the time. But, otherwise, I mean, you know. I live in New York, and I'm around most of the time. Downtown. Come down and see me.
Excellent. And you have Stakeland 2 coming up on, it's October 15th. Is that correct?
I'm not positive, to be honest with you. I think it's either the 15th or the 19th on Sci-Fi Channel. It's playing some festivals right now. It's going to the Toronto at the Dark Fest, and it's playing in Sitges in Spain. And then it premieres on Sci-Fi. It's either the 15th or the 19th. I'm not positive which.
Excellent. I can't wait to see it. So thanks again, sir. Really appreciate it. And thanks to all you listeners out there for checking this episode out. As always, make certain to like, subscribe, share, use the comments section, check out our YouTube show. Just search for Screamatics on YouTube. Make certain to use the Amazon links at the bottom of the page to buy Mr. D'Amici's films and The Last Man on Earth. Remember, any purchase you make through our Amazon store, you know, it helps us out here at the studio and ensures that there will be an episode next week. In any case, we'll see you next week, gang. Until then, have a great weekend.
Don't cry. There's nothing to cry about. We're all safe now.